summer will mark the 38th anniversary of our marriage, my wife Maxine and I. And anniversaries, at least wedding anniversaries, are very important and very precious to me. And I hope, of course, of all of you happy people as well. If you're not happy, maybe you're not so anxious and happy about them. I'd like to say that our marriage of 38 years is a happy one. And each year seems better than the last. Now, in my ministry and in the 38 years since we've been married, I've noticed, though, that there have been some marriages that have not been as happy as ours has been. And I've been observing, you know, why. Why is it that our marriage is happy, rewarding, fulfilling, something we treasure very, very dearly, and yet some people, it seems like from the very beginning, have nothing but a wretched, terrible marriage? Now, in evaluating this, first looking at myself, I'd like to say that I have a very fine wife. Very fine, wonderful wife. You know, she is very interested in my welfare, my well-being. She's concerned about me in every way. And I'm the second most important thing in her life. And the first important thing, of course, is God. And she does her best to be a good homemaker, a good cook, a good companion, and a good wife. She tries hard to help me and to be a part of my life, my work, and my ministry. And she enjoys being with me. And there have been times over the years when we have had to be with each other 24 hours a day, day after day, week after week, even month after month. I'd like to say that she's pleasant, she's congenial, she's considerate, she's kind. And now I suppose some of you men might say, well, now, if I had a wife like that, well, I would have a happy marriage, too. But now let's consider the other side. I also have tried to do my part. I have tried to be a good provider, and I'm very greatly concerned about her welfare. And she is by far the most precious physical thing that I have in this life. Now, you might, some of you, take objection to that. You know that something that I have. You know, she belongs to me. Well, let me also say the reverse is so. Yes, she belongs to me, but I belong to her. She is mine, and I am hers, as they say. Now, I want her to be a big part of my life, my work, and my ministry. And I like to be with her, too. And I have enjoyed the times, even when we had to be with each other 24 hours a day, as I said, week in and week out. Now, I try to be pleasant. I try to be kind. I try to be considerate to her. Now, there's one basic ingredient in our marriage that I think that has made it successful and also that has made it lasting. And by saying these things, I hope you think that it has not all been a bed of roses. It has not always been easy. It has not always been pleasant. But it has been a very successful and, as I said, a very rewarding, a very fulfilling, a very happy marriage. But that basic ingredient that I think that we have that many do not have is that we both want to give of ourselves to the other. And it's not a matter of seeing what we can get or what we can take from the other. Now, when we married 38 years ago, and I might confess that I believe I was about 19, or not quite 19 years old. When we were married 38 years ago, we believed that it was going to be for life. We believed it was for better or worse, or in sickness or in health. And I don't know what the minister said. I suppose the next day I probably couldn't have told you what he said. But I think we said, I do or I will or something similar to that. Remember the occasion, but not the exact words that were mentioned. But over those 38 years, we have gone through those very things. We have gone through the times that were better, and we have gone through the times that were worse. We have gone through the times when we had poverty for years, and we were in want, at least at times. And also, we have gone through times of plenty. We have gone through periods of health, and we have gone through periods of sickness for both of us. And I can remember quite a number of occasions when I sincerely thought that the chances were very good that my wife would never see the morning. And I'm telling you, when she was going through the valley of death, I was going through it as well. And possibly if one comes close to death in a marriage, the other can realize then more easily how precious the sick one is and how terrible it would be to lose the other. Maybe that's one of the reasons why our marriage has been successful, because we've been through that. Other people have not had that opportunity, maybe. And maybe all they see is the bad, but maybe in such occasion they might begin to see the good as well. As I've mentioned, we've seen sad, unhappy, wretched marriages, and we've usually seen why they were that way. And some have been very close to us in our own family. And when your own family is going through difficulties of this kind, it's very traumatic for everyone, not just for the husband and the wife, but for the parents and for the children and for all others. And we have gone through that. Back in 1974, according to statistics, in the United States, 40% of the marriages were ending in divorce. I don't know what the figures are since that time. I would presume they're greater. And some authorities in this particular field have estimated that 50% of the marriages either end in divorce or separation in the United States. And, of course, in some places, sometimes they have just as many marriages as they have divorces. And in addition to 50% ending in divorce or separation, 25% live in a situation where there is hatred or disgust against one or against each other. An additional 15%, that's 15%, desert their mate. That leaves 5 to 10%, apparently, of successful marriages in the United States. That's sort of one of those read 'em and weep figures. And on the one hand, marriage can be the greatest blessing that a man or a woman might wish for in the physical existence, or it can be the greatest curse, depending on what the husbands and wives do with their marriage, what they make of it. And sadly, too many are cursed. And the reason, of course, is that they are violating the basic laws of God relating to marriage. I remember when I was young, my best friend's father said one time, he says, "I can't get along with my wife, and I can't get along without her." And I suppose that's the story of a lot of marriages. Can't get along with and can't get along without. How sad. One has said in regard to marriage, it begins with a prince kissing an angel. It ends with a bald-headed man looking across the table at a fat woman. Another has said, in fact, this is from the French proverb, marriage is fever in reverse. It starts with heat and ends with cold. Well, those things are a little amusing, but how true they are. We live today in what some have said is a user society. You use something, and then you throw it away. And too often, this carries over in our marriages as well. And the people have the concept, if your marriage doesn't work, get divorced, and get a new wife or a new husband. Get a new model. And, of course, the newer models are always, I guess, more exciting and so on to many people. But sadly, some new models, as some might think, aren't as good as the old ones. And so we have people marrying and divorcing and remarrying and divorcing and remarrying almost ad infinitum. I can remember back when I was young that divorce was a no-no. And it was almost an unheard of thing, at least in the circles that I was in that particular time. But it's not that way anymore. Even Dear Abby, you know, will counsel if you have a little bit of trouble in your marriage, well, so what? Go get divorced and get somebody else. Now, sadly, the church is not exempt from marital problems. And I'm sure that all of you know of people in the church who have had marital problems or who are having marital problems, or maybe you are. And I hope that the percentage is a whole lot better than the figures that I recited a little while ago of maybe only 5 or 10% of the marriages being successful. I would hope and expect and believe that it's much, much better than that. But sadly, I know that there are a lot of people in the Church of God who have serious marital problems. And as ministers, we are from time to time and sometimes an awful lot of the time approached by people who have marital problems. And sometimes they're very, very difficult. Sometimes they're very upsetting for all the people concerned, and they're certainly very, very sad and traumatic. But it seems as time continues that things seem to be getting worse in God's church, not necessarily in the last few months, but I'm speaking in an overall way. It seems like things seem to be getting worse over the years, and that more seem to be having serious marital problems. Now, we all surely know the Bible instructions that God gives to husbands, the instructions that God gives to wives in regard to marriage. And I know at least from the time that I have been in God's church, I have heard many, many sermons, and I've given quite a number of sermons on that particular subject. That's not the purpose that I want to fulfill here this afternoon, to go back and, you know, to say, well, now, here's the husband's duty, here's the wife's duty, or to say, here's what God says to husbands, here's what God says to wives, at least in the main. I just want to touch on some of those points. I'd rather get down to what I think is the basic reason, the basic cause for all of this difficulty. Now, knowing what God has said, and I presume surely all of us here do, and as we look around, we see some in the church who have, the people who have heard sermons along this line, or they have read in the Bible, and the wife will, you know, say, well, the Bible says my husband is supposed to do such and such. And the husband will say, well, I look in the Bible, and my wife is supposed to do this, that, or the other thing. And she doesn't do it, or he doesn't do it. Or they will go counsel with a minister, and then the one will say to the other, or say to others about the spouse, that they don't do what the minister said. And they think, you know, now, if you would just do what the minister said, husband or wife, or if you would do what God says, then our marriage would be successful. It's all your fault. And so we have problems, and so often, you know, it's the other person's fault. It's not our fault, it's usually the other, the husband or the wife, depending on who is speaking. And it seems like some of the problems and some of the faults are unsolvable. And sometimes when you hear someone saying, you know, he did, he didn't, or she did, she didn't, and they start arguing, bickering back and forth, maybe even before a minister, you know, the minister will hear the husband say, well, now, the reason why we're having this problem is she did this, and she did that, and she did something else. And then she will probably deny all of those things and start saying, now, what he did or what he didn't do. And I suppose that in order to solve some of those problems, if you were going to deal with the little problems that they bring, would require a Solomon, a modern Solomon, and that modern Solomon would have to have full-time duty to decide who is right in every single occasion, to find out who is right, who is wrong, to be there, to be the judge, and to be a referee, you might say, to find out who is wrong in all of those things. And that, of course, is not going to be the solution to problems in marriage. Because all of these little things that people harp about are really evidence of much deeper faults and problems. And I want to, as I said a little bit earlier, want to get to the basic problems that bring all of this about. Because these problems, the little things, the little complaints, and of course they aren't so very little when they're told, it seems, these are evidence, or evidence rather, of much deeper faults. So often, people who are having marital problems, they get into shouting matches or fights, I'll put that in quotes, because maybe they aren't literal knockdown dragout, and sometimes they are. But whether it's a shouting match or whether it's a fight, it requires two people. There's a very familiar proverb that surely you're all aware of. I won't turn there, but Proverbs 15:1, it says, "A soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger." And I think that works in most cases, but I've heard some even say, even when I give a soft answer, it doesn't solve the problem. Now, if you're having marital problems, or if you know of someone who is having marital problems, you or the other person probably thinks that something is wrong with the spouse. And I mentioned that a little bit earlier. You know, it's usually the other person's fault. It's not usually our fault. But I'd like to ask you wives, what do you want in a husband? I suppose you would like to have in a husband a perfect gentleman and a perfect father, a great lover, one who is always kind and considerate, one who is helpful, one who is never cross, of course, or never angry, one who is a good provider. Maybe I should put that word, excellent provider. Industrious, very concerned about the home and its upkeep, and, of course, taking care of those things. Dependable, predictable, well-groomed, beautiful, handsome, ad infinitum. Now, I suppose the wives would like to have this, the husband would like to have this as a wife. He'd like to have, of course, a perfect lady. Maybe I should put the next one first, and a great lover. A wife who is kind, who is considerate, who is gentle, who is domestic, an excellent cook, of course, and housekeeper, always appropriately or neatly dressed, always ravishingly beautiful, and I suppose just like she was on the wedding day. Now, what such people want is perfection in a mate. You know, they want to have the perfect wife or the perfect husband. Actually, what they want is something that does not exist. All of you have heard or heard of Mr. Armstrong's comments over the years, particularly in past years, in his marriage to Loma Dillon Armstrong, who died some years ago. Mr. Armstrong, on many occasions, praised and complimented his wife publicly. He did this quite often before the church, I believe in his autobiography, and also privately and personally. And I think some thought, well, Mr. Armstrong married the perfect wife, and so of course he would have a happy marriage. But on one occasion, I didn't hear this personally, but someone else recounted it to me, Mr. Armstrong said, well, if I would have emphasized the negative things about my wife, people would think she was a very poor wife. And it seems like people who are having marital difficulties, they're emphasizing the bad things, and they don't say very much about the good things. I'll have a little bit more to say about that a little later. Now, you will never find perfection in a spouse. You know, I think I have a wonderful wife, but she's not perfect. I think she's about as imperfect as I am. And I suspect that you also, whoever you are, husband or wife, that your spouse is just about as imperfect as you are. None of us are perfect. And yet some of us, I think, are looking for perfection in our spouse without being perfect ourselves. This reminds me of a story of a single man, and someone asked him, you know, why don't you get married? And he says, well, I've been looking for a long, long while. I've been looking for years for a wife. I've been looking for the right wife. You know, I've been looking for a perfect wife. And he says something like this. He says, you know, I've concluded that there are none. And so he remained single. You know, he would have been the perfect catch, the perfect husband, but there were no people on earth, I guess, to match that. And so he continued on in his bachelorhood. Now, that's one little bit amusing extreme, possibly. Let's go to the opposite extreme. The man who says, well, now, what you need to do when you get married is to find a woman and then bring her to perfection after the marriage. Now, let me say this, that if you are anticipating marriage and you think that you're going to bring your wife or your husband to perfection, you're doomed to failure. And that's really what has happened to a lot of marriages, where the husband or the wife, you know, has in their own mind what they want in a husband or a wife, and not finding that, well, then they find, you know, the next best thing, and so then they think that they're going to change their husband or their wife into, you might say, their own image or what they think the husband or the wife should be. As I say, you're doomed to failure. Now, I guess we want our spouse, or at least many do, to be perfect. At least our idea of perfection, and as I said just a moment ago, in other words, to make the spouse over in our own image, to our likes or our dislikes. Do what we want so that the spouse will do what we want, when we want, and how we want. And that just doesn't work because, you see, each one of us is a unique individual. Each one of us is totally different from every other human being, as far as I would understand and believe, a different human being than has walked this earth or ever will. Now, they say, I don't know who they are, but anyway, they say that everyone has a different fingerprint. And I guess we all have different toe prints, if we would take them. And we're all different. I never cease to be amazed as I travel a lot and visit a lot of churches and a lot of people and see people in my travels of how different people are. And I have never seen any yet that, as far as I know, were exactly alike. And even twins, you know, are not exactly alike. There are differences. And yet we, sometimes, in the spouse, want to have someone that's just the way we want them to be rather than the way they are. We're all unique individuals, and we ought to realize that, accept that, and treat them like the individual they are, made in the image of God, with the same opportunity to attain eternal life as we have. I think some of us may look down on the wife, or maybe the husband, and think that we have a better end with God. You know, that we maybe are already saved, or already practically in God's kingdom. Maybe we have one foot already in God's kingdom, and then the poor spouse, you know, is sort of on a lesser plane. But we all have the same opportunity to attain eternal life. We're all God's servants, and we need to realize that we're all in the same plane, we're all in the same boat, and we're not, you know, a step above the other. I'd like to read here to you a little bit from a small book that we have over here in our college bookstore. And I'm sure that many of you are familiar with it. Probably a lot of you have read this book, little book, Letters to Karen. Now, there are also some others for the man's point of view that the same author wrote, Letters to Philip. And I wanted to read just one very short letter here, just a page and a half. On page 33 of this particular book, Letters to Karen, and this now is a book on keeping love in marriage, and it's by Charlie Shedd, and he is writing this to his daughter about marriage. My dear Karen, thought you might enjoy something from your own family background. In musing on the imperfections which turn up in our perfect sweethearts, he put the word perfect in quotes, after the wedding, I remembered this one. You see, when she was a sweetheart, his wife was, well, she was perfect. But after he got married, he was in for a shock. When we were married, your mother couldn't abide my habit of leaving the dresser drawers open. But honestly, I thought this is how it was supposed to be. A man wants a shirt, so he makes his selection from the top drawer and leaves the drawer open. He needs socks. Make the choice from drawer 3 and leave it open. I'm telling you the truth. I thought that closing drawers was one reason God created woman. My mother had been closing dresser drawers behind me for 22 years. But in less than 22 hours, I discovered that my new bride simply couldn't tolerate this utter thoughtlessness. I'm almost embarrassed to tell you what sent me into tantrums in her behavior. I discovered to my horror that this beautiful creature I was tied to forever had a horrendous habit. She squeezed the toothpaste tube in the middle rather than carefully rolling it from the bottom. You see, there are some things that you might not find out about your intended before marriage. Because, you know, you never could know that how she squeezed the toothpaste or what she or he did in regard to the shelves or in regard to the drawers. Why did she do this awful thing? Because she had always squeezed it that way. Her family couldn't care less about toothpaste tubes. But they did care about drawers. For them, closing drawers was a symbol of things done decently and in order. It also had another meaning. It signified that each member of the household was being considerate of every other member. Of course, it all seems silly now. This, incidentally, is another of the nice things life has a way of doing for us. It makes things look funny from a distance, which were anything but that close up. I hope you'll have a million laughs as you open up the clown rooms inside yourselves. And yours for fun, Dad. Now, the next page continues, and I'll read another two or three pages in the next little letter or chapter. My dear Karen, high on the list of happy marriages which your mother and I have known is a union between Bob and Helen. On the surface, they seem to have little in common. Bob is a pusher. She is retiring. He is the life of the party. You'll usually find her in the shadows, but they are radiantly in love. We noticed at first at a banquet while some visiting speakers was giving his address. Part of the time, they held hands. Now and then, they looked at each other with a sly smile as if they were reading loud and clear some silent message between them. Then one night, we were invited to dinner at their house. You would have loved it. He went to the kitchen a couple of times, and I heard him ask if there was anything he could do. Imagine asking a wife, you know, is there anything I could do? Once she said, no thanks, honey, take it easy. The next time, she let him pour the water. When he went to the table, he held her chair, and then of all things, he served her first. I don't know what the etiquette books say about this, but my guess is it wouldn't have shamed him one bit. And she didn't protest. She sat there glowing as if this was the way to do things, and wasn't life wonderful? And it was. The whole dinner was a thing of beauty. Several times in the conversation, he asked her opinion on some subject and even listened while she told what she thought about it. When the meal was finished, he rose to help her clear the table. After dinner, while he and I were alone in the den, I asked to find out more about this. Bob, I said, you and Helen seem so perfectly adjusted to each other. I've watched you for some time now, and I think it's great. I see so many unhappy marriages. Do you have any secrets I might pass on to others? He laughed a bit, but more in hesitation than embarrassment. In a few moments, he recited a story, which I think is classic. We had a terrible time when we were first married, he began. And I might say, you know, in my marriage, the hardest time we had was in our first year. I don't know why it was, but it seemed like living with Grandma didn't work out very well. My grandma. Well, we didn't live with her, but we rented an apartment, and her apartment was right next to us. It was her apartment, by the way. She owned the apartment house. And so we had our problems. We've all had our problems, as far as that's concerned, but I hope that the things I'll say today will help us to solve those problems. So anyway, he said, we had a terrible time when we were first married. In fact, we even talked about calling it quits. Then we read something that gave us an idea. We decided to make a list of all the things we didn't like about each other. Of course, it was hard, but Helen gave me hers, and I gave her mine. I presume the list was pretty long, if it's like most marriages. It was pretty rough reading, you know, what she said about him. Some of the things we had never said out loud or shared in any way. Next, we did something which might seem foolish, so I hope you won't laugh. We went to the trash basket in the backyard and burned those two lists of bad things. We watched them go up in smoke, put our arms around each other for the first time in a long while. Then we went back into the house and made a list of all the good things we could dig up about each other. This took some time since we were pretty down on our marriage. But we kept at it. And when we finished, we did another thing which might look silly. Come on back in the bedroom and I'll show you. It was a neat room, lots of light, and a happy spread on the big old bed from Grandma's house. But at the focal point in that bedroom wall, there were two plain maple frames. And in them, what do you suppose? In one was a list of the good things Helen could see in Bob. In the other was his scribbled list of her virtues. That's all there was. Just two scratchy lists behind glass. If we have any secret, Bob continued, I guess this is it. We agreed to read these things at least once a day. Of course, we know them by heart now. I couldn't begin to tell you what they've done for me. I recite them to myself sometimes when I'm driving the car or waiting on a customer. When I hear fellows complain about their wives, I think of my list and thank my lucky stars. Funny, too, the more I consider the good she sees in me, the more I try to be like that. And when I really understood her good points, I tried all the harder to build on these. Now, I think she's the most wonderful person in the world. I guess she sort of likes me, too. That's all there is to it. That's all, the man says, but it goes right to the heart of great marriage. This kind of love has a way of gradually canceling out the bad and raising up the good. I thought maybe that might help you a little bit, encourage you a little bit, too, because so often, you know, we look on the negative side, and I know that there have been a lot of people in the church who have looked on the negative side in regard to the church and what the church has done or supposed to have done or thought to have done or what somebody has done or hasn't done or thought to have done and so forth. And we look on the negative side, and we never look at the good things. And when we look in the church of God and see that it's from the church and from Mr. Armstrong that we have learned the truth, we have learned the way to eternal life, we have learned the way to happiness and so on, we have learned, you might say, things that relate to the trunk of the tree. What if maybe some of the twigs might seem for a while to be maybe not the way we would like them to be? And so often, when we come to understand the truth, it's not bad anyway, those things that we may think are bad. Now, in marriages, it's common to say that there are three principal sources of problems. Now, there are others, but here are the three major ones of why marriages supposedly do not succeed. One is communication. Husband and wife can't communicate. Number two is sex. And number three, finances. I'd like to make some brief comments now about both of these, or all three of these. First, in regard to communication. Some years ago, I guess it was about 10 years ago now, one of the departments that I was responsible for in Big Sandy had a couple men in the department who never could get along. This wasn't in a marriage, of course, but it brings out a point that I want to emphasize. The one man came to me and he says, you know, this other man, he says, he won't communicate. And so obviously they couldn't get along if this other fellow wouldn't communicate with him. Well, it was some weeks after that the other fellow came to me complaining about the first man. He says, you know, well, the problem in this department is, and the reason why we can't get along, why we're having all these problems, is he won't communicate. Now, they both thought the other had the same problem. Communication, whether it's in business or whether it's between two individuals or whether it's in marriage, is a two-way street. And if you're going to be a good communicator, you have to be a good listener. How is the other person going to communicate to you if you don't listen? And so listening is just about as much, communicating is just about as much listening as it is talking. But most of us, you know, we think of it as the other way around. You know, well, communication is when I talk to somebody else, not when they talk to me. And so it is in marriage. You know, the husband wants to do all the talking, he wants to do all the saying, he wants to run everything, or maybe the wife does. It requires, as I said, as much listening as talking. It requires patience to see the other person's point of view. And we, whether we're a husband or a wife, need to understand the point of view of our spouse. Now, why is the problem? Why is there a problem in communication between husbands and wives? Usually one, or maybe both, do not want to hear or to consider the other person's point of view, the other person's problem. And they do not want to change or to conform. And they are not willing to go halfway when, of course, there is disagreement on a particular point. When it gets right down, though, to the basic reason why communications is a problem, it's because of selfishness on the part of one or on the part of both. We can put it a different way, and that is to want to get instead of to give. Usually, the problems that we see in others are the very problems that we have. And I have seen that so many, 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 many times. And I have thought a number of times when people have complained, and I've heard them complain about the church or about Mr. Armstrong or about somebody else, and usually the things that they are accusing or complaining about, they themselves are guilty of. And so it is in marriage so often that one person is complaining about the husband or the wife, really they're guilty of the very same thing that they're accusing the other of. So it gets down, in my estimation, to one basic principle, that the reason why people have difficulty in communicating in marriage is because of selfishness on their part. The second thing I mentioned was sex. Now, why are there problems in regard to sex? Of course, these are very large subjects. I can't say very much about them, but just touch on one or two aspects of it. Now, a problem often comes, as far as the husband is concerned, because, whether he realizes it or not, he wants to gratify himself, he wants to satisfy himself. He is not considerate of his wife. He is not kind with her and patient. I'm thinking now in relation specifically to sex. He is not wanting to give or to share with his wife. He just wants to take. He just wants to get. He just wants to receive. And she is, as so many say, you know, just a, quote, sex object. Now, from the wife's point of view, or maybe I should say the husband's point of view in looking at the wife, that maybe she refuses to use the old King James term, but I'm sure you all understand, she may refuse her, quote, conjugal dues. 1 Corinthians 7, of course, mentions that. And so she may punish or reward her husband and use sex, then, as you might call it, a weapon, but use it anyway in the marriage to get what she wants. In other words, she is selling or refusing to sell herself. We call it by a sort of an ugly word, otherwise we don't think of it so much in marriage, but it's called prostitution. And in a sense, I think sometimes we have that in marriage, where the wife, you know, is selling herself. How cheap. Again now, whether it's the husband's problem that often occurs, as I mentioned, of wanting to gratify the self, or the wife, you know, just trying to use this as a bargaining agent or whatever, the problem is selfishness. The problem is to get, you know, what can I get from my husband? What can I get from my wife? I want to get this, I want to get that, rather than give. The third major problem that I mentioned was finance. And it seems like so often nowadays, people can't make ends meet. You know, the outgo exceeds the income. And this is a common problem. And whether you make $1,000 or $10,000 or $100,000 or $1,000,000 a year, at least for many people, it's not enough. Some think, you know, if I could just have a 30% increase or a 10% or a 50% increase, that would solve my problem, the financial problem. But it doesn't. You know, if you can't get by on what you have, if you had twice as much, you wouldn't get by on that either. Anyway, people can't make ends meet. They don't have the dollars that they want to do what they want. And oftentimes this is, you know, because the husband doesn't make as much as the Joneses do, or Mr. Jones, or he doesn't make as much as someone else. Or maybe one or both spouses, might be the husband, might be the wife, or might be both of them, spend money on things that the other one does not think the money should be spent on. And in some cases, you know, it's a matter of trying to keep up with the Joneses with maybe a salary that is not equal to the Joneses. But again, what is the basic problem? The basic problem is that a person is selfish, or both of them are selfish. They're in the attitude of getting, not giving. And as I have been trying to relay to you, that really this is the basic problem of all marital difficulties, in my estimation. Now, I can remember of a particular marriage that I happened to be involved in, that I knew a great deal about. And in this particular marriage, one spouse, in my estimation, is about the most selfish person I've ever seen. And that got me to thinking along this line, because then I began to realize what really is the basic problem of all marriage difficulties. And that is that one or both of the spouses are selfish. And you know, there are all kinds of degrees of selfishness. I think he was just the most selfish. But whether he were half that selfish or one-fourth that selfish, I suppose that the marriage was doomed to failure sooner or later anyway, as far as that's concerned. Selfishness, or to put it in different words, the attitude of wanting to get and not give. You know, to do things my way, to do what I want, do things how I want it done, when I want it done. And in this particular case, the spouse that was so selfish was a man. And he knew what the Bible said the responsibilities were for a husband. He had gone through Ambassador College. He had graduated from Ambassador College. He had taken the classes that we have that relate to marriage. And I guess he read in there, you know, that the husband is the head of the wife. And I guess that's about all he needed to know. And he was set on being the head, without any consideration for his wife. And everything had to be his way. You see, he was the king. He was the emperor. He was the great I Am. Now, many never learn this principle of selfishness and never realize that that is the basic problem. They think that it's finances. They think that it's sex, or that she's a shrew, or that he's a tyrant. Whatever the problem is, when you get it down to its most basic aspect, I think you'll find that selfishness, or that attitude of get rather than give, is really what the problem is. There's an old German proverb that a little bit relates to this. And of course, we should, in our marriages, learn things. God wants us to learn from the marriage relationship, because His Son, Jesus Christ, is later going to have a marriage relationship with us. And the church is going to be the bride of Jesus Christ. We have some important lessons, all of us, to learn. And some aren't learning that lesson. I wonder if they don't learn that lesson in their own home, in their own marriages, maybe they won't be able to be a part of that marriage with Jesus Christ. Anyway, this old German proverb goes as follows. Marriage is a school in which the pupil learns too late. I guess that's somewhat like the other German proverb, you know, that we get too soon old and too late smart. Sorry, I can't pronounce it like maybe some of our German brethren might, but I think you understand. The attitude that so many have is that what can I get out of my spouse? What can I get out of this marriage? Now, maybe they don't think of it consciously this way, but by their actions and by what they do, this is really what the thing is. You know, what can I get? The way of get, being self-centered, being selfish, of getting and not giving, the opposite way of love. And, of course, one of the most basic, I think the most basic principle in the Bible is the way of love. Now, when people have problems of selfishness, deep selfishness, either one or both, When we have these problems, it really shows that we haven't grown very much spiritually. And of course, I'm addressing an audience that should be spiritual. And not only should we be maturing spiritually, we should be maturing emotionally. We should be maturing in our marriage. We should be showing love in our marriage. But when we find the problems that do exist sometimes in the church, I think it's very obvious that we haven't grown very much spiritually or emotionally. We haven't grown very much in love. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the very serious and deep-rooted problems that we have. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we've always had sermons and articles on the subject of marriage and God's way in marriage. We've had broadcasts on the subject. We've had telecasts on the subject. And we've, many of us at least, I guess, had personal counsel from ministers in the church in regard to marriage. Learning God's way, and what basically is that way in marriage? It's the way of giving, of serving. And whether you're a husband or whether you're a wife, it should be a way of serving the other. All of this instruction that we have all had seems to have done no good in too many cases. And it seems like the teaching, the answers to the problems, shed off us like water off a duck's back. And there is no action or insufficient action to make the marriage a success. And I think, again, of that particular marriage that I referred to a little bit earlier, of where the man had gone through Ambassador College, he'd been a church member many years, and when he got married, it was evident from the very first day that, as I said, at least in my estimation, he is the most selfish person that I have ever known. I feel sorry for that man. I don't know if he realizes that, but that's his basic problem. Hopefully someday he will. Now, since your mate or your prospective mate, your husband or your wife, is not perfect, and neither are you, what can you do about it? In other words, you're having problems, and I hope that you realize or will come to realize that you are not perfect, and you're about as imperfect probably as your spouse is. What can you do? I'd like to quote a couple statements from this same author, Charlie Shedd. He said, it is not so much finding the right person, that is, for marriage, as it is being the right person. I want to repeat that. It is not so much finding the right person. There's a great deal of emphasis on that, and I think there should be. But if you're going to marry, be sure you find the right person. But he says, it's not so much finding the right person as it is being the right person. To put it a little differently, one person said, quoted in this particular, from this particular author, he says, I was operating under the delusion that I needed a new husband. Here is a woman now, and she was operating under the delusion, since the marriage was failing, that she needed a new husband. Then one day it occurred to me that perhaps my husband needed a new wife. Now, do you realize that if your husband or your wife has a problem of selfishness, they are not doing their part, that you can't change them one bit? And of course, one reason why some marriages fail is because one tries to make over the other in their own image and is doomed to failure. There is only one person that you can change, and there is only one person I can change. You can only change you, and I can only change me. And of course, we're going to have to have a lot of help from God in order to change ourselves. You can't change your spouse, but you can change yourself. And so often when people are having marital problems, maybe the wife will say, well, I won't change until he does. Or he will say, I won't change until she does. Well, now that's an impasse and it leads to nowhere. If you're going to wait for the other person to make a change, you're doomed to failure. There is an old proverb that says, this is not in the Bible, where one is wise, two are happy. Now, you can't change the other person, and maybe they're stupid, and maybe they're unwise, and maybe they're selfish. You can't change that person. But if you are wise, if you apply the biblical principles, if you change your life, then maybe two can become happy. Maybe the spouse will see, well, you know, my wife or husband here is really trying to do well, showing love and kindness and consideration. Maybe it'll be catching, and maybe they will learn the same lesson. So what we need to do, if we are having problems, is to make ourselves over, to change, to make self-improvement,
Or,
you might say, to get on a drive of self-improvement, to do our part. I know so often in the work of God, we find that people want to do somebody else's job. They think the other person isn't doing the job the way it ought to be done. And we would like to change that particular person. Well, of course, they're not our servant. They don't work for us. They work for somebody else. And yet, you know, we're dissatisfied with what they're doing or what they're not doing. And so we're critical of that. But we can't change them. All we can do is do the best job we can. And let God take care of the other person. And maybe we need to do a little bit of that in marriage as well. The wife or the husband isn't doing the way they ought to do. Well, then we need to make the change. Do our part. That's really all we can do. Do our part and let God take care of it. So we need to make changes so that we will fulfill the purposes that God gave in marriage. And if we have time, maybe I'll read just briefly a few verses that relate to all of this. We need to make those changes in our lives and try to please our spouse, try to give, try to perform whatever our responsibility is, whether we're a husband or a wife, to be kind, to be considerate, to be merciful, to be forgiving, to do special things, do little things maybe that would indicate to the other person our concern for them and our love for them, and that we are on the giving rather on the getting way. I remember very well that when I was a boy, my grandmother told me in regard to her relationship with my grandfather, she says, you know, we have a bear in the house. We have a bear, B-E-A-R, in the house. I didn't know what she meant. She says, well, he has to bear with me and I have to bear with him. Let's put it another way. You know, people say, well, marriage is a 50-50 proposition. You know, you go halfway and the other person goes halfway. Why not go 100% of the way? Why not go all the way? Rather than just going to half the way and say, well, now I've done my half, I've done my part, now you better do yours. We need to be a healer of family ills. Maybe we need some of us who are having marital problems, I'm thinking now of a husband, to go back and do the first work. By that, I mean go back and court your wife. How did you win your wife to start with? You've lost her possibly, or at least you think you have, or at least the marriage is going to pot. Well, why don't you go back and act like you did when you were trying to get her to marry you? You know, be a lover, even physically, but not the kind probably that you have been, otherwise maybe you wouldn't be having these problems. Have a second honeymoon. And I don't mean, you know, just a week or 2 weeks or a month. You know, try to have a perpetual honeymoon. Now, when my wife and I went on our honeymoon, we were gone 3 days. That was quite a honeymoon, I guess, back in those times. At least it seemed like it was quite a while. And sometimes someone will hear that my wife and I are going to go somewhere or do something, just two of us, and oh, they sort of light up. Oh, well, you can have a second honeymoon. Well, we've been on a honeymoon for a long while. It didn't end with those 3 days. Now, maybe the honeymoon hit a few rocks along the way, especially that first year, and from time to time since. But, you know, we've been on a honeymoon, and you ought to try to do that in your life. To court your wife, just like you did before marriage, to have that same outgoing concern for her now that maybe you had been. And be a lover, not just in the physical sense, but from God's point of view. And if you are showing love, of course, you're giving, not getting. Giving of the self. You know, we ought to show more love, more of that outgoing concern to our husband or our wife than we should to any other person on earth. And that's one thing that Mr. Armstrong emphasized over the years that I thought was a very valuable thing to know. And he was saying how that some wives dress up beautifully to go out to the public, and then they maybe look like a hag or whatever at home. It ought to be the other way around, as far as that's concerned. Some people treat other people with deference, with politeness, with respect and kindness, and then they treat their mate like a mongrel dog. It should not be that way. Now, let's turn, just in a few closing minutes here, to a couple of scriptures, a couple of very basic scriptures on the subject of marriage. At least the first one is, and the second one you might not have thought of in this way, but I'd like to apply it. in regard to marriage. First, Ephesians 5. Ephesians 5 and verse 22. Wives, be subject to your husbands. Now, a lot of men really like that. And that means, wife, you are a lower life form than I am. You are the slave. Now, that sounds amusing, but I'm telling you it's a terrible tragedy in some of our families. Because this is the attitude that some husbands have. Notice verse 21. I purposely started on verse 22. In the Revised Standard Version, and I'm reading from that, the paragraph starts with verse 21. And what does that say? This is speaking now to Christians. And I presume, at least in most of our marriages here today, that we are brothers and sisters in Christ. And yet I think some of us think, well, now I'm a brother in Christ, but my wife, she's down on a different level than I am. Be subject one to another out of reverence for Christ. Then continuing, wives, be subject to your husbands as to the Lord. And I realize that that is God's instruction, and that's what the wife should do. And sometime I suppose that's about the greatest trial that she'll ever face in her life because of the kind of husband that she has. Now, when you look and see how the head of the church, how Jesus Christ treats his church, and how much love and consideration and kindness he has towards his church, you'll find that not very many husbands are that kind of a husband. In fact, I don't think any of them measure up to that. For the husband is the head of the wife. It doesn't say, you know, that he is as we might think in the vernacular, the Lord and Master, or the King, or the Emperor, or even, you know, the great I Am, as some seem to think they are, or at least act that way. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. You see, Christ is going to save the church. Sadly, a lot of husbands are not saving their wives, they're destroying them. As the church is subject to Christ, so let wives also be subject in everything to their husbands. And again, you know, a lot of husbands really delight in this verse, and they'd like to close the Bible right there. Husbands, love your wives. Now, what does it mean to love your wife? It means to have outgoing concern, to be on the giving rather than the getting. And in sadly too many cases, it's the other way around. The husband, you know, is going to get all he can out of his wife. She's going to scrub the floors and scrub the pots and pans and shine his shoes. And I could go on, I suppose, and say a lot of other things maybe that some husbands think their wives ought to do. She's his virtual slave. Now, Jesus Christ does not treat the church that way. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. And in some marriages, I said, you know, it's not a matter of the husband giving himself to his wife, but rather getting everything out of her he can. That he might sanctify her. You know, he might set her apart. She's very special. Yes, we might say she's on a pedestal. And I guess he ought to be on a pedestal, too, as far as that's concerned. Not worshiping, but to respect and to admire and to love. That he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word. That he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. Now, some men, I think, look on their wives as though she's just a slut, or she's, as I said, sort of a second-class citizen. God is going to make the wife of Jesus Christ, or Jesus Christ is going to make his wife, holy and without blemish. Even so, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. You know, if you read these verses up here about what the wife is supposed to do, let's go back and look at it. It's verse 22. And verse 22, 23, and 24. Then what does it say for the husbands? Verse 25, verse 26. You might say for several verses here now, it goes on and tells the husband what he ought to do. And I think the greatest fault, at least in those marriages where I have been involved, the greatest fault has lain with the husband in the church. God has more instruction for us, brethren, as husbands, in here. And I think the greater responsibility of making the marriage work is on our shoulders. And some have miserably failed. Now, let's pick it up in verse 28 again. Even so, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no man ever hates his own flesh, but it seems like some would hate their wives, but nourishes and cherishes it, as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one. This is a great mystery, and I take it to mean Christ and the church, but he's applying a physical thing in a spiritual way, and it applies to both. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. Now, let's turn back a little way to 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. You all know what chapter 13 is. That's what we call the love chapter of the Bible. And when we look for a definition of love, here it is, starting in verse 4. And I would like to apply this today in regard to our marriages. Whether we're husband or wife, we're supposed to love. And people talk a lot about love. You know, I love my wife, I love my husband. And supposedly that's one of the reasons, or the main reason, why people get married. Because they love the other party. Now, if we really love the other person, here then is a description of what we feel, what we do, how we act towards the other, towards the spouse. Love is patient. Here is a problem, of course, in many marriages, where the husband or the wife is impatient with the other. And kind, and some are very unkind towards the other. Love is not jealous or boastful. You know, the husband is not the great I am, and I hope I'm not taking God's name in vain because that's one of the names of God, but I hope that it conveys the attitude that some people seem to have even in God's church. It is not arrogant, and some of us are arrogant towards our spouse. Or rude. Love does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrong, but rejoices in the right. Love bears all things, or put up with all circumstances, I guess we might say. Believes all things. I think that might relate to having the positive approach rather than the negative approach. Hopes all things, and endures all things. That's what real love is, brethren. And we ought to show that kind of love in our marriage. Now, if we show that kind of love in our marriage, that outgoing concern, the giving rather than the getting, then our marriages are going to develop into beautiful ones. Now, there's been a man who has been telling the world that there are two basic ways of life, that of get and that of give. Now, we hear that. We agree with that man that that's what's wrong with the world today. That's why the world is in such a mess, because the world is on the getting rather than on the giving side. Now, what some of us, I believe, have not realized is that this is also what is wrong in our marriages. So, brethren, let me leave you with this thought. Learn to give, not get. In your marriage, and you too will have a happy and an enduring marriage.